The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
I got a job at a Young Offenders Institute, which is the equivalent of a prison for children. And it was very obvious to me that we were really damaging children when they came into that kind of custodial environment. They were traumatised by the process, and I realised that we were doing something really wrong treating children that way. And so that led me to realising that working in the criminal justice system, specialising with children, was something that was really important for me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Hearing. I'm Janelle Wrigley, your host for this week's episode, which features a conversation I had with Aika Stevenson. Aika is an expert in youth justice, and she's the founder of a charity called Just for Kids Law. And that charity is essentially a law firm that provides legal advice and representation for children that are caught up in the criminal justice system. Aika is also the author of a recently published book called In Their Defense, Fighting for Youth Justice, One Child at a Time. I found Aika's experience, her perspective, to be really eye-opening about what children go through and what they experience when they become involved in the criminal justice system. I learned a great deal both from speaking to her and from reading her book. So if you are interested in the issues that are facing our youth, or if you're interested in the criminal justice system, whether you're in the UK or in the US or really anywhere in the world, I think you'll find Aika's perspective and her experience really gives you a lot to think about. And if you're a longtime listener, you may remember an episode we did on The Hearing several years ago with her colleague, Shauneen Lamb. And that's also worth checking out on many of these similar issues. So with that, here is my conversation with Aika Stevenson, and I hope you enjoy.
The Hearing.
Hello, everyone. Joining us on the podcast today is Aika Stevenson, the founder of Just for Kids Law and an expert in youth justice. Hello, Aika. Thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Hi, Janelle. I'm very pleased to be here.
I wanted to start today by asking you if you could tell our listeners just a little bit about the charity that you founded, Just for Kids Law, and its mission, you know, what you do now.
So I founded Just for Kids Law about 18 years ago with another colleague, Shauneen Lamb. And we both felt that that being a lawyer presented you with a unique opportunity in a child's life. And we felt that we wanted to take that opportunity to cash in on sort of that trusting relationship that you have with a young person. And to see whether we could really use that to advocate for young people in multiple aspects of their life. So rather than just simply looking at a criminal issue, we tried to take more of a holistic approach by looking at multiple factors that were affecting that young person and the fact that they had come into the criminal justice system.
And your own background, you talk about this quite a bit in your book, which we'll get to in a second. But your own background sort of led you into both founding Just for Kids Law and your interest in the youth justice system. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit sort of about yourself and about your journey into law and how you ended up here today.
Yeah, so initially it was quite basic in that my dad went to prison when I was 10 years old, and I think he'd been before when I was a little bit younger, but I remember at 10, like me really sort of understanding that and feeling like I just wanted to get him out of custody. So I was, so very basic. I just sort of said, I want to be a lawyer so that I can get him released. And then, you know, I watched lots of episodes of LA Law and Ally McBeal. I was set on that mission really from that point. But then when I was about 15, there were lots of other things that I was experiencing in my life with other young people. And I think that has been fairly important in sort of defining the way I view the views of children and their ability to have agency over the decisions that they make, because I myself and my peers were struggling with different issues at that time. And then when I was in my early, maybe 20, 21, I'd been through law school and I was working as a corporate paralegal in a law firm just to get some money. And I wasn't really sure how I could practice specifically working with children. But then I got a job at a Young Offenders Institute, which is the equivalent of a prison for children. And it was very obvious to me that we were really damaging children when they came into that kind of custodial environment. You know, I would see that within 48 hours, those children were, it was almost transformative in their ability to kind of empathize and detach. And they were traumatized by the process. And I realized that we were doing something really wrong when we were treating children that way. And so that all of those things combined kind of led me to realizing that working in the criminal justice system, specializing with children, was something that was really important for me.
Yeah. And has it been 18 years since you founded Just for Kids Law? And so what is the kind of size of the organization now? And how many children are you able to help at kind of any one time in a direct way?
Well, unfortunately, because of funding issues, we've had to go through significant reduction in size in the last 12 months, actually. So up until 12 months ago, we had around 40 members of staff, and we were sort of taking on around 700, or we were representing around 700 clients a year. 700 clients or cases. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, now we've had to significantly reduce our size. So we now only have 10 members of staff. We have a team of 5 lawyers currently. And then we have some other members of staff who are dealing with policy work and influencing mm-hmm. in terms of the government, that sort of thing, and then a couple of admin and sort of office manager. But yeah, so we've significantly shrunk. In terms of criminal proceedings, we're representing around 200 to 250 clients a year.
Wow, yeah. And are your funding sources primarily from government sources? Is it private contributions? How does that work? It's so unfortunate that you've had to face cutbacks.
Yeah, so we have taken a number of strategic challenges against the government. And so we have always tried not to take government funding. Sometimes there are specific funds that are set up by the government that are kind of one step removed from the government. And so we may have, on a couple of occasions, we've been able to access those funds, but generally we don't take sort of government funding, save from, we have legal aid contracts with the legal aid agency, which right. enable us to be paid as representatives. But generally we are funded by trusts and foundations, a tiny bit of, sometimes, you know, we might have corporate funding,
right?
But not very much. But yeah, primarily trusts and foundations and individual donations.
I see. Okay. You recently wrote a book called In Their Defense, Fighting for Youth Justice, One Child at a Time. And I'll just throw objectivity out the window and say that I really enjoyed reading this book. Enjoy is a bit of a strange word because it's quite harrowing, a lot of what you discuss. But I just found it, it's such a mix of being very educational about the youth justice system through the cases that you've had and really walking the reader through chapter by chapter, kind of each stage of that system. But it's also a resource for parents or for children who may be going through the system. And it's about you a little bit too, and your background and how you came into this. So I really enjoyed reading it. And I'm curious what inspired you to decide to write this book.
I think, so the opportunity was presented to us by the publisher who attended an event. So I wouldn't necessarily say I went out to seek a publishing deal.
That's often how it happens.
So. Yeah. And so, and then when I met the publisher and saw what they were interested in writing about, then I could see the value in it, because raising the profile of the work and allowing people to understand more about what actually happens to children in the legal system is something that's really important to me. I think too often people hear about the kind of the headlines, the worst cases, the cases that label children evil, and actually my day-to-day job is not, it doesn't involve those cases. They are a rarity. But I think that's all that people hear, so they believe that's the norm. Mm-hmm. And actually, a lot of what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis, I think that most people would be shocked by. And it was important for me to kind of get the message out there as well to parents, because I think too often children are placed in legal situations. Their parents kind of have trust and faith in that system, and they may just go along with it without realizing the significance of an outcome for their child, and the long-term impact of that.
Right.
So it's really important to me to sort of raise that awareness. And also, you know, other professionals like youth workers, social workers, there are lots of people out there that are able to influence and support children. And I thought it was really important that they have a more accessible general understanding so that they know when to get children help as and when they require it.
Right. One of the things you talk about in the book is sort of a sliding scale of the types of children that end up in the youth criminal justice system, or who end up as your clients. On one end, from those that sort of unwittingly end up in the criminal system, almost. And then on the other end, those who are really kind of trapped in it by their life circumstances. And so I wanted to start with that first one, because I was really struck by some of the cases you describe, where a child throws a plastic bottle at somebody on a bus, and then the next thing they know, you know, they're being called into the police station for an interview. And as you're saying, the parents may not realize the wheels that are now turning. So can you talk a little bit about that impulse that you see to kind of criminalize conduct that maybe should be dealt with in other ways, and how that plays out in your work?
Yeah, I think there's not enough recognition that sometimes children are just children and they do things that are impulsive or reckless, silly, sometimes even unkind. But my issue really is, should that behavior end up in criminal court? And also, I think my issue is that often it's only certain children that are prosecuted. So it's children from Black and racialized backgrounds that you see proceeding through the courts, whereas many other children that wouldn't have even come to the attention of the police. Children experiencing poverty. I believe these children are over-policed and over-prosecuted. Sometimes it's not just that. Sometimes it can be that a particular parent is very upset about an incident and reports it to the police. And then once it's been reported to the police, they then have to go through investigating that incident. But I think that generally there is lots of things that most people would probably admit to having done as a child are criminalized, and that is my biggest issue.
Yeah, and you talk about that. You know, everyone has their kind of part to play in the criminal justice system, and so once that police interview starts, you know, the wheels start turning. It can be very difficult to kind of stop that process, and as you say, especially for children that are, you know, maybe have fewer resources, who may be subject to racism within that system too. So, I mean, one thing you emphasize in the book is the need, if possible, for somebody like you to come in, you know, as early as possible to help that child, which I found really interesting. This ties in as well to another thread that really comes through in the book, which is just adults, you know, from lawyers to parents to the magistrates, sort of failing to understand the ways that children are not, they're not miniature adults. They're different. Their brains work differently. You talk about, especially for Black children, this can be, you know, the adultification, sort of a difficulty in seeing children and understanding the ways they're different and seeing them as sometimes victims rather than, you know, as criminals. And you start by saying, you know, even at the police interview, you prefer to kind of, if you can, talk to the children without their parents present, just because of the way they see the whole, can see the whole situation differently in ways that adults don't always understand. Yeah. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, well, I think with an adult, they understand the significance of explaining things. You know, often they understand the significance of explaining relevant information to their lawyer. For, you know, they'll understand that they're there to sort of give an account in relation to an allegation. And they won't necessarily have the same barriers that a children might have or the same thought process that a children might have about the responses that they give you. So, for example, for a child, I could be there discussing, you know, quite a serious allegation. And for a child, it may be, you know, I've had a situation where a young person didn't tell me something really important because they didn't want their parents to find out that they smoked. And, you know, that it's just so, whereas with an adult, they would understand that the smoking is irrelevant. They just need to talk to me about their potential defense. But for children, the smoking light is the most significant thing, because in their mind, you know, this young person was thinking, well, you know, I'm innocent. I didn't have anything to do with that situation anyway. But what is most important is that my parents don't find out that I smoke, because that's the thing that's going to impact my life. And I think that is, that can happen time and time again with children. And you can completely miss the point. They might not tell you something relevant to a particular defense, or something really important about their, you know, that is mitigating on their behalf, because actually what they are thinking about can be some, you know, something entirely different that is governing the way, the instructions that they're giving you. And I think that, you know, that is a real issue.
Right. And then that carries through, of course, to, you know, you talk a little bit about your children's brains just aren't, their frontal cortexes aren't developed really in the same way that somebody, you know, who's older is, in terms of judgment and decision making. And you know, even as you said, 48 hours in detention in the criminal justice system might have permanent impacts on children. And you talk about the sliding scale of the types of children who may end up in the criminal justice system. And there are some children, you know, who you describe it as, who get caught in kind of a horrible web or a worsening spiral, where they have difficult life circumstances. You know, maybe they're experiencing poverty, they're subject to racism, mental health issues, you know, a whole host of factors. And then once kind of in the criminal justice system, it just becomes, you know, they're just trapped in it almost. And I was curious, you know, what you think we can do better for these children?
Yeah, well, often the issues start much really early for those children. And what's really sad is that I've represented a significant number of children who have been diagnosed with special educational needs, autism, ADHD, things that have been significantly impacting them for a really long time, and they are diagnosed through criminal proceedings rather than through the education system. And that, I find that really hard, because not only have they they have experienced like cumulative disadvantage on a number of occasions prior to even entering the legal system. And they've almost given up, you know, because they've always been labelled as bad. They've always been labelled as having behaviour issues, behaviour problems, and nobody's really looked behind that behaviour. And I think when you're starting with a child in that position at 15, it's really hard. And there's only, you know, so much you can do. And so I think when we have children who go through psychological assessments of their criminal proceedings, and then, you know, it's finally they're told, well, actually you have autism spectrum disorder and you're suffering symptoms of PTSD because of these significant events that have happened in your childhood. I think it's actually quite overwhelming for them, because, you know, had somebody picked up on that earlier, then A, maybe they might not be in the legal system, but B, then they also might not have been excluded from school. And I think, you know, it can be really overwhelming. And, you know, as lawyers, we're not best placed to tell them about their, you know, trying to, a lot of work actually needs to go into explaining to a young person why they're not bad and why having autism might impact the way that they make decisions and how that's not necessarily a label that is going to be negative for them, how that can be positive. This requires lots of skilled work. And if that had happened with a child at 6 years old, there would be a whole package of support that would go around that. They would have had a life where people understood the decisions they made, you know. And so, you know, I think that's what's really difficult, because there's so much to unpick at that point, and trying to get them all of the help at that time can be really difficult.
Right. And that leads into a question I wanted to ask you, which is, if, you know, if you could sort of snap your fingers and implement one change tomorrow to the youth justice system, you know, what would it be? Is there one thing that could really make a big impact?
The hearing. You're an attorney with a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. With superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence. Be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
From the war in Gaza.
There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
To the front lines in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News Podcast is there. We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes, every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
If you could implement one change tomorrow to the youth justice system, what would it be?
Well, in the UK, I mean, our age of criminal responsibility is 10 years old. So, immediately, I have an issue with that. I represented 2 10-year-olds last year, and they couldn't even understand the police caution and the significance of it. And then, you know, one of my clients held their breath throughout the whole interview, because it was quite clear to me that he wouldn't be able to cope with it. He couldn't answer questions. So I wrote a statement on his behalf and asked him to remain silent. And he literally held his breath throughout the whole interview. This is not a process it wasn't created for the interviewing of children. Therefore, it's completely ineffective in terms of interviewing children. And so that is, you know, a big issue for me. And then we also have a process whereby children have to make admissions often to be diverted out of the system. And I think there's lots of complexity around why children might not accept their involvement in a criminal matter at the first opportunity. And I think we need to have a lot more understanding around why children can't quite grasp that they might be guilty of a criminal offence. And so I think that those two things would have a massive impact on the number of children that are criminalised each year in the UK.
That's heartbreaking to
hear. There's so much that I would love to change, but I mean, just if there were two little things that could make a difference.
Right.
But yeah, obviously I have massive problems with a lot of the system and the process.
Yeah. I mean, I almost felt that every chapter in your book could be a book.
It was very much just touching the surface and trying to raise awareness of some things that I think are big issues for me that I see in day in, day out. But you're right. Yeah. You're right. Every chapter could have been a book.
It's so heartbreaking to even hear about your client who is holding their breath during the interview. I'm curious how the work that you do just emotionally has to be very difficult on a day-to-day basis. I know it's not the most important thing compared to what these children are going through, but how do you kind of take care of yourself, I guess, is I'm curious to know.
I have two children myself. And so I think that had I not had my own children, then I probably would just be working day and night. But I think that once you have your own children, then that does make you kind of have a cutoff and think about, you know, yeah, and then I need to make time for them and be present for them and do my best for them. I also have lots of friends and family and a partner, and you know, I put a lot of time into spending time with my friends and family outside of work. You know, I'm definitely a person that feeds off like kind of social interaction, which is probably why I do what I do, and I get a lot from having sort of fun times with friends and family outside of work. But it's hard, I think, when you choose this kind of career, it becomes a vocation. Running an organization, setting up a charity, it kind of becomes part of you, and it's quite hard to compartmentalize it, you know, and create those boundaries that lots of people talk about. But I think, you know, I do my best is all I can say. But you know, it's really hard to not to. You can't work with children and be detached. It's just impossible because they know. They know whether you really care about them or not. And they can figure you out quite quickly. And if I want to do authentic work in the way that I do and really have children and young people trust me, then I kind of need to care. Right. And so, yeah, it is just about how I manage that outside of the job.
And are there other organizations that are doing similar work? I mean, how do other, for the children who can't come through Just for Kids Law, so what are their options?
There is a small but kind of growing community of lawyers who choose to specialize in representing children. And, you know, for most of that, for all of those people, actually, thinking of the lawyers that I know that work in sort of private law firms, they all do it because they really enjoy representing children and they see the hope in it. But I think it is more difficult when you're trying to do that in a profit-making firm. I think the great thing about our organisation being a not-for-profit is you don't have to worry about those billing targets and the profit margin. I think a lot of people are kind of doing these cases and working over and above under the radar and probably being criticised as a result in profit-making firms. So I think, you know, we kind of just call it what it is and don't expect to make a profit. But then I think it's really important that that people understand that, because the legal aid fees are really bad. And so you can't do all the additional work that is required if you are, you know, basing how many hours work you're going to do on the legal aid fee you'll be paid. Mm-hmm. Because we, you know, this is why this work has to be supplemented by trusts and foundations and people that really care about ensuring that these children have access to justice.
Right. You mentioned too, this is more of a kind of minor and very practical recommendation, but you mentioned at one point in the book also the need for magistrates who kind of understand these issues and understand children's issues more. And I was surprised to learn that you don't have to be a lawyer to be a magistrate. That's something kind of anybody can look into. What is the path to becoming, to getting involved in that way?
anyone can apply to become a magistrate. Sadly, you know, it is often kind of middle class white men and women who are kind of at the point of retiring, maybe, you know, not always, they're not always particularly old, you know, or people who are kind of working part time and thinking about semi-retirement, often ex-head teachers or, and so, you know, there's definitely a lack of diversity. And yeah, essentially any of those people can apply. They do have a specific training before, and they do have to have a further training in order to be a magistrate in the youth court. But it's just not enough, I think, to create, to get a real understanding. I think there's very few people who are magistrates who have lived experience of the issues that the young people face. And so I think it's really important that there needs to be a drive for people with lived experience to be recruited into the magistracy. Mm. Also, there is still, you know, it's very kind of, it can be very pompous and they can be caught up in sort of old fashioned traditions. So the magistrates in youth courts are supposed to, they've kind of, a lot of them have been designed to be less intimidating than the Crown Court. However, you know, there are still very much the approach of magistrates can be really alienating for a child when they walk in there, because they might immediately say, right, well, take your hat off, or, you know, sit up straight, listen to me, you know. And there has been training to try and stop that from happening, but unfortunately it still happens. And I think there's a real lack of understanding of how, what that young person might be going through, and the fact that they wear their hood up as a form of protection for themselves, or just recoiling into the trauma of the situation. And there's not enough that is done to actually show understanding, show kindness, and actually create a real connection. And when I have seen magistrates, there are some magistrates that do understand that and do really make that effort. It's been eye-opening, because you actually see the young person that you've been working with actually talking to the magistrate in a way that is real and authentic, and is, has far more of an impact than just, you know, a child who just sees them as kind of part of the enforcement process, and doesn't really engage in it.
Right. Yeah. To build more trust. And how do you, when you encounter the children, what are the ways that you kind of try to build trust with them as well, and get them to open up to you in the way that they need to, for you to be able to represent them?
Yeah, I think we start with trying to meet basic needs. So basic, you know, sort of asking them how they are, or doing lots of background reading if we have that information already, so they don't have to repeat themselves. But understanding, you know, what might be going on for them before you meet them, we'll ensure that whenever a child is coming to the office, we have snacks, we have food, we make sure that they are, that we've assisted them in getting here. You know, there might be particular areas that they feel scared to go through or to walk through, so we'll get them an Uber to the office. You know, there was, and so I think when your starting point is kind of understanding where they're coming from, and showing them that this is a safe place, we're here for you, we care about you, and we're on your side, I think that that's a really good place to start. It doesn't mean that, you know, clients automatically meet, you know, will open up to me because they've had a few snacks, but I think it starts that process of understanding that this is a trusting relationship, and it's important that you understand I'm here for you.
Yeah. So for our listeners who, many of whom are in the UK, and as well as elsewhere, and many of whom are legal professionals, is there anything that they can do to help make the system better, to help individual children, that you could recommend?
If we're talking about lawyers that are working in the system, I think criminal lawyers need to recognise, you know, rather than just these few people that decide to specialise, I think that criminal lawyers that do practice need to recognise that they they have a duty to ensure that they are effectively educated and trained around representing children. You know, it's really important that we put the time in to ensuring that we can take instructions from our client, that we can work in a trauma-informed way, that we're really understanding what's going on for them so that we don't miss important information that relates to their defence or their mitigation. And then for other professionals, I think it's getting some understanding of the legal system so that they really understand what these children are potentially up against, also so that they can spot bad practice and really support those children to get the best possible outcome. And then I think for the general public, it's kind of recognising that there is, you know, should this behaviour be criminalised? You know, and maybe thinking about that being more of a, you know, a public issue, you know, what's happening to our children. I think that all we see is that, you know, serious youth violence in the UK, particularly in the daily headlines, and not enough kind of understanding of what's going on for children.
Right. Yeah. We're just about at time. Is there anything else you want our listeners to know or our listeners to do about the youth justice system or about the work that you do?
I think if they don't have enough understanding already, then reading the book would give them more awareness, obviously making donations to Just for Kids so that we can continue this work. And yeah, just sort of having a bit more understanding and not just focusing on the headlines.
Right. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for writing the book and for the work that you do. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
The Hearing.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this week's episode. We hope you enjoyed it. As always, we really appreciate any feedback you have for us or any suggestions for guests that we might feature on a future episode. And we'll see you next time.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.